The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Welcome. It's Guardian First Book Award Week and we finally have our winner.
And the winner is Alexandra Harris for Romantic Monarchs.
Goodness, I didn't think this speech would make it out of my handbag, but I'm completely amazed and delighted to be picking up this envelope for a book which started as a doctoral thesis, and I used to spur myself on in the library by thinking that maybe three people might call it up from the Bodleian Stacks, maybe even four, and now this has happened, and it's just beyond wildest dreams. Your faith in this book, I suppose, feels like a vote of confidence, not just in me, but in the whole idea that what academics do in libraries can have a broader readership, and it's a tough time for the humanities, and I hope there's a good future ahead for us. Thank you ever so much.
Congratulations to Alexandra Harris, who'll be telling us more about herself shortly. We'll also be hearing from a writer who has won innumerable gongs over several decades, though you wouldn't think it to hear him.
There are some writers who set their sights on the Nobel Prize before they even pick up the pen. Elias Canetti is like that, and I'm afraid Thomas Mann. Never underestimate the role of the will in the artistic life. Some writers are all will. Talent you can dispense with, but not will. Will is paramount. Not joy, not delight, but grim application.
Now, can there be any one of you who doesn't recognise that as the voice of Alan Bennett? We'll also be meeting some of the teenagers who travelled halfway across England to meet an octogenarian novelist at the Guardian Book Club. So, lucky Alexandra Harris to have won a prize with her very first book. That's Romantic Moderns, of course. And as one of the judges, I want to say, and rightly so. Now, you may remember that we took her out for a day to the Berkshire village of Cookham, where, sitting outside a very pleasant pub and pretending that she hadn't won, although actually we knew she had, she described the doctoral thesis that led her to the book.
I wanted to write a thesis which brought together my passion for Virginia Woolf on the one hand and neo-romantic painting on the other hand. And I'd never seen the two things mentioned in the same paragraph before, and yet it seemed to me that a novel like Between the Acts, full of all that sense of layered history, had to have something to do with the landscape paintings being done at exactly the same time. So I thought of all this one night in an attic in St John's Wood, and I wrote it all down in a spider diagram, and 5 years later this book emerged. I handed in my doctoral thesis, and it was a very anguished, long drawn out argument, and then sat down to try and pull it all apart again and make it slightly readable.
So you had to rewrite it?
I rewrote the whole thing. In fact, I was flicking back through a notebook yesterday and I saw a little note to myself: Alex, feeling very ill, horrible big task, where to start?
And one of the things is, of course, chucking out all the footnotes.
I've put the footnotes at the back in very small print. What I really had to chuck out were the very long, close readings of literature that you needed to actually have read the book I was talking about first.
So it's even longer. The thesis was longer than this.
I think they're about the same length, but with different lots of material. So in the book, you won't find out much about the second typescript of Between the Acts and the minor revisions occurring therein.
Yeah.
However, you get the gardens and the food in the book, which you didn't get in the doctorate.
Which definitely must be a plus. So in your Q&A for Guardian Review, you said that you wrote very anguishedly about Virginia Woolf and your tutors told you off when you were at Oxford.
I wrote very strange essays on Virginia Woolf. My undergraduate thesis was on spots and splashes in Woolf, and I was told afterwards that they didn't know whether to give it a 50 or an 80 because no one had any idea what I was on about. But I'm still quite obsessed by blots and splashes. And in fact, they get into the weather chapter in this book, where I became very interested in places where art is not pure. It gets little messy bits on it for a long time.
So somebody with an easel that gets rained on, that sort of thing.
Yes, that sort of thing. And in Wolf's case, it tends to be doodles. She has lots and lots of characters doing strange, blotty doodles, or just letting the ink from a pen seep out. And then the next person who comes along doesn't quite know what's there to be found in that pattern. So those places in the margins were interesting.
So what's your next thing going to be?
Well, I've just finished writing a very short biography of Virginia Woolf, which was heaven just to sink into her diaries and letters. But the next big project is about the weather, and it's really a cultural history of our relationship to our weather in England.
It's England again. Why, you've done modernism and weather, both international phenomena. Mm. Why are you so focused on England?
Clearly everywhere has weather and interesting weather. So one might write this book about France, but I'm particularly fascinated by this problem that we seem to have at the moment about talking about England and talking about local places. We're very anxious about it, lest we seem insular. It's politically taboo sometimes. And so I really want to find some kind of way of talking about national identity in a big, broad, inclusive fashion, because, of course, we do have hugely diverse communities here, and people from all kinds of different backgrounds can relate to the same particular place. And I think it's one of the things that can hold very disparate people together. So for me, there's a political challenge here as well.
And of course, in Romantic Moderns, they're relating to Europeans all the time, aren't they?
Absolutely. And I wanted to get over this divide that we get in some books between the international and the insular. Piper and Sutherland have been written about in the past as the most insular, inward-looking artists, and yet they're not. They're part of what's so special is their deep understanding of European traditions and their great love for it all, and their way of creating a dialogue between home and abroad.
Now, a little bird told me that there are some television companies sniffing around this book. Are you going to become the next Sister Wendy Beckett?
Do I have to become a nun first?
I think we'll allow you not to take the habit, but
if anyone's asking, I would be extremely happy to do that. She was a great hero for me, and that sense of introducing a general audience to works of art that absolutely command our attention is one of my great passions. I do think it's very important that universities also look out and share the intense specialist research that goes on inside the university, and then sometimes go and tell other people about it too and learn from other people. So I would love to be one of those people who can cross the bridge.
The wonderful Alexandra Harris, and may her bridges be long and various. And now to Alan Bennett. But lucky Simon Hattonstone.
I thought he was great. The reason I thought he was great was because he's not really like you'd expect him to be.
In what way was he different?
Well, I think lots of people expect him to be really cuddly and, you know, this national treasure figure. But I think he's much more spiky. He's much more opinionated. He's quite difficult in a way. And I quite like difficult people. And there's something about him. What I like about him is that even when he agrees with you, he'll start by answering. His first words will be, "No."
I always think of him as an Eeyore figure, actually. I don't think of him as cuddly. But then I was trying to think of, since he did the Riverbank stories, I was trying to think of one of the Riverbank characters he is, and it struck me that he's actually Badger.
I mean, it's weird that people do think he's going to be so cuddly, because his characters aren't, his stories aren't. If you think so many of those great monologues, the TV monologues, they're all curtain twitchers, and they're all kind of very judgmental people, and they're all slightly sour, aren't they? Yeah. So it is weird that we'd expect him to be so sweet.
Now, his biography, which came out in paperback earlier this year, is called A Life Like Other People's. I don't really get the feeling that he has had a life like other people's in many different ways.
I think he's always kind of lived it how he wanted, hasn't he? I remember, I thought it was interesting years ago when Ian McKellen wanted to out him. and he'd never really talked about his sexuality till a few years ago, and he refused to be outed.
Yeah.
And then it emerged that it wasn't just that he found it distasteful, it was that actually it was more complicated than that anyway, because he'd had a relationship with a woman for 14
years. Now, he's also had he has had a lot of very important professional relationships, particularly with Nick Heitner, who's directed a lot of his plays.
Yeah.
He talked to you about how life changed for him when he became seriously ill. Let's hear a bit of that.
Has life turned out better than you expected?
Well, it's got better. It hasn't got worse. I mean, some things have got worse. I mean, one's health gets worse. But I met my partner 18 years ago, and we're very happy.
Like, the whole love business has been a bit of a turn-up, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, it's not quite like that, really. I had cancer in 1997. That somehow eased everything, really. I know that sounds an awful thing to say, but I suppose it made you think about the things that really mattered, really. But yet, at the same time, it also made me put a spurt on work-wise, and I've done much more since then, probably, than before. But the other thing, which again is quite dull to say, is that I've been very lucky, and there's so many things in which... Anyway, I was very lucky in starting to work with Nick in 1990. And he said I'm part of his luck. Well, he's certainly part of mine.
And you have been a real team, haven't you?
Well, I don't think of it as a team, really. It's just, but
what do you think of?
Well, I just think, you know, I come along to this office. It's not like teamwork, but I suppose it is teamwork. I don't know. I don't want to know. I don't want to know how it works. I don't want to know what he puts in, what I put in. I just want it to happen. And I'm frightened if one analyses it too carefully. It won't happen, you know. It's like kicking a football. You don't know how to do it, but if you can do it, then that's fine.
You were saying about the cancer having eased things. Two things. You were saying about how it eased things, and also you said you started talking about your partner, and I couldn't work out what was going on.
Well, because before then, we'd been together, but we didn't actually live in the same house.
Yeah.
And then when I was ill, he had to move in to look after me, really. So, and then, because I never thought I could live in the same house with anybody. And then when I was ill, he moved in, and we found it worked. And so we've been in the same house ever since.
Why did you think you could never live in the same house?
Because I couldn't work if there was somebody in the house. If somebody came in to clean, I couldn't work till they'd gone. I don't know why I just couldn't. I just needed to be have the place to myself, really.
Definitely a badger, I think. But Simon, he also talked about his politics. Where does he come from politically?
Well, again, I found that interesting and quite encouraging, because Alan Bennett, again, I think is someone you'd almost think of as being apolitical. And he's not. He said he's always been on the left. He's always been left of New Labour. He says it's probably been left of Old Labour. He's certainly been Old Labour. And I think it's a very traditional, rooted sense of a working class or lower middle class kid getting the opportunity to go to grammar school, going to Oxford, and coming up in a world where, you know, the welfare state had been established, kids were getting more opportunities to go to university, and he saw it becoming a more and more egalitarian society. And I think one of the great disappointments for him has been that it hasn't been, and that Labour blew that opportunity.
Yeah, that was probably the source of his great success with History Boys.
Have you been surprised by how successful History Boys and this one have been?
Yes, genuinely surprised at the time, surprised since.
Are these your biggest successes, really?
I think the History Boys is, certainly.
What do people like about it? What do people get into so much?
In a way, you know where you're going. All these things only occur to me afterwards. They're rationalisations, really. It never occurred to me when I was writing. You know, the play has a definite trajectory. These boys want to get into Oxford and Cambridge. They end up getting into Oxford and Cambridge. And in the process, you actually get to know these eight boys. And when the curtain comes down, you want to go on knowing what's happened to them. You want still to be a part of their lives. And that's what I always feel about plays that I like. When the curtain comes down, you actually want to go on and want to know what's happening. And you become personally drawn into it. And it didn't occur to me when I was writing it that was the way it would work, but certainly that's the way it did work.
You were at Cambridge, weren't you?
Well, I was at Oxford. I went to Cambridge in the army. I learnt Russian in the army on national service and went to Cambridge then for a year.
Were you really clever?
No, I wasn't. Looking back, there was always somebody much cleverer than I was at school. I wasn't the top of the class always. I wanted to get away from Leeds, so, you know, I didn't want to go to Leeds University.
But had you known anyone who'd been to Oxford or Cambridge?
No.
So were you like seen as the swotty freak?
No, because there were about eight of us who went in for the exam, and not all in history, but in various other subjects. There were about eight of us went up for one or other of the places, all of us in the end. It took some longer than others, but in the end we all got there.
Really?
Yeah.
And was that from Leeds Grammar?
No, not Leeds Grammar. Leeds Grammar sent boys all the time. No, it's from a school then called Leeds Modern School, which was Lawnswood School, which is on, you know, when you're going out of Leeds, it's on your left just before you get to the Ring Road. It was a big, long building. It was now demolished.
So was it a grammar school?
Yes, it was a grammar school, yes.
But
it wasn't the grammar school. It was a public school, really.
It just goes to show you can take the boy out of Leeds, but you can't take Leeds out of the boy. He's still got a very, very strong accent for somebody who's lived in London for such a long time.
Yeah. I love it when he's talking about the things that have made him happy in life, how miserable he sounds.
Yeah, yeah. So how happy is he?
I would say, and you'd probably better whisper it, but I think he's pretty happy. You know, his memoir was brilliantly successful. The last two plays, The History Boys and The Habit of Art, which is now being turned into a film, have probably been his most successful plays. You know, he's doing all right in his relationship. He's just written an absolutely gorgeous short story for the London Review of Books, which is being turned into a short book and is fabulously dirty. I mean, that's another change in him. He's become much less inhibited as a writer. And I mean, as he said to me in the interview, you know, I could never have talked about things like sucking people off when my parents were alive. And he said it's a Philip Roth thing. It's once the parents are dead, he feels he can talk about the things that he might have like to have talked about years ago.
I mean, that brings us to another point, which is there is a life in the writing that is very vibrant in its own right, isn't it? And sometimes it's not the same as the life that one hears, even him speaking.
Yeah.
Let's hear a little bit more about him talking about exactly what writing means to him.
Do you always enjoyed writing, Alan? Do you find it hard?
I find plots hard. I find making things happen hard. I don't find what people say is hard. I don't find dialogue hard. But I do find shaping it is hard, and always have. And it gets harder in a way as you get to know more. I mean, for instance, 40 years on, it's an incredibly difficult structure. But of course, when you're writing your first play, you don't know that. You don't know what you can do and what you can't do.
I'm so relieved you said that, because I thought you were going to say to me, explain 40 years on, and I would have been like, Christ.
It's a play within a play within a play, and I don't know, it all comes together in the end, but it's not something that I'd ever attempt again. But the only reason I attempted, because I didn't know, and I was young. But as you get older, you know what the limitations are, so it gets harder.
And I thought it was interesting in The Habit of Art, when, I can't remember, it's Auden who says most of the stuff, but about the battle between talent and will.
Will, yeah. No, that's me, not him. Here we are. There are some writers who set their sights on the Nobel Prize before they even pick up the pen. Elias Canetti is like that, and I'm afraid Thomas Mann. Never underestimate the role of the will in the artistic life. Some writers are all will. Talent you can dispense with, but not will. Will is paramount. Not joy, not delight, but grim application.
And is that something relevant to your writing?
I think it's true. I think unless without grim application, you get nowhere. But one would like to think one has got more than will.
And have you got The Habit of Art? Is that something you had talked about before you wrote this play?
I suppose I have, because I've been doing it for 50 years. But So, but you know, I think as Nick said in the documentary, so of everybody, so of the actors doing the play, so is he directing it. So we all have.
So do you have a regimented routine? Do you get up every day and write?
Yes, it gets later when we're starting, but
and what time do you start?
I start about 10:30.
What time did you used to start?
I used to start 9:30, I think.
And what time do you go on to?
Well, I go on all day, but that doesn't mean I don't break off and go shopping and do all other things. I didn't used to be able to write later on in the day. Now I can. I don't know why. I can write between 6 and 9, which I didn't used to be able to do. And that is habit, you know. You've got to do it, otherwise you get nowhere if you just wait for things to strike you.
And do you enjoy the writing?
When it's going well. When it's not, you think it's hopeless and you're never going to get anywhere. But then writers are always like that. That's why they're such miseries.
Alan Bennett, whose play The Habit of Art has been one of this year's treats at the National Theatre. For those of you who missed it, like me, don't worry. His memoir, A Life Like Other People's, is now out in handy paperback from Faber, and it's one of the 24 titles that have been picked for the Big World Night giveaway next March. More news of that on guardian.co.uk/books. And finally, back to science fiction for a second week. Or should we say fantasy, or perhaps speculative fiction? That discussion is still running. As regular subscribers to our podcast know, the veteran author Russell Hoban came into the Guardian Book Club a week ago to discuss his groundbreaking novel of 30 years ago, Ridley Walker. It was one of the first apocalyptic visions of life after the bomb. And an inspired English teacher from Bristol Grammar School brought 10 of his students up to London to hear Russell talk.
We've had this book chosen by our English teacher to include in our coursework. And so as we've studied it, our interests have grown and we found out that this conference was going on and the opportunity arose for us to come. And it's been great.
So what is it that you find interesting about it?
Well, quite a lot of it's about the language. We were given it for a summer read, really, and something like that where you pick it up and it's a challenge as soon as you read it, but after the first chapter, it's more of an indulgence thing than a challenge because you can read the language. And we're also studying Chaucer as well, so be able to mix the two, really, and find out the depths of the language where one's actually the past English and one's an imagined future English is really great to study.
Can you speak Ridley Walkerese? Can anyone come up with a sentence? Come on.
Mr. Clare might be able to.
But it's full of little phrases, isn't it, that it would be lovely to think you could remember. What we've been and what we come to. And the last sentence of the novel, Rowan, can you remember that? He's found his own track. And he says, I wouldn't have no other track. That seems to be marvellous. It's so gnomic. It's so full of wisdom, I think.
Do you think of it as science fiction or fantasy, or how do you classify it?
I would say it's got elements of fantasy and science fiction in it, but it's not wholly either because it's not a created world. It's an extension of future prediction of what our world will become. So it has continuity in terms of language and culture and the fragments of tradition that remain. It has continuity with our contemporary world now, so it's not completely different. So I think it's its own genre.
It's a book about fantasy. It's a book about how we make myths, what myths are, what stories are, and how we negotiate things like history, our past, and what that means in the future. So by setting it in the future, Hoban is able to play all sorts of games through the language, through the mythic fragments that remain in this futuristic world, resonances which make sense to us as readers in the 21st century, but also have very timeless themes in terms of how myth, story, fiction is created.
Now, he said that somebody mentioned in the talk Ian Banks, and he said lots of people had jumped on the bandwagon. Do any of you read other books like this, or do you think it's unique?
One of the aspects of the course that we do at Bristol Grammar School is that we bring together books that people choose because they have a sort of synoptic aspect. So everybody here is writing about Ridley Walker in the context of another novel or another work that they've chosen. And people can say what things they've got, but some people are writing in the, about him in terms of Beckett's Endgame, A Clockwork Orange, The Cherry Orchard, things like that. So they might not seem to have an immediate relevance, but we all have themes in mind, which I suppose have been fed by tonight's interview with Russ as well.
Were you surprised by him at all? Did was he what you had expected?
Well, I was quite surprised in how abrupt perhaps his answers were, but then again, perhaps that's only to be expected given that there's a great sense in a lot of his works that he's not making it up on the spot, but it's very there's a lot of intuition in it, and it's quite a compulsory style of writing, so I suppose that sort of answer is what you can expect. He doesn't plan in detail what he's going to write. It's a kind of dynamic process, and so the answers are similar to that.
I want to hear from some of the girls. This sort of fiction is often quite... Boys tend to prefer it. Do you think that you equally like it?
I think it's for both sexes, really. I don't really think that it's more boys or more girls. I think it's enjoyable for both sexes. If you look at the history of language and folk etymology and how language has evolved, you can apply that in Ridley Walker, and you can see where Russell Hoban's got his concept for the language of the future from. And I think that appeals to both sexes.
Perhaps there is a element that it's to do with physical strength. So perhaps women are not as strong in this world. So it's back to it's kind of a reduction of how far we've come now.
Mm. So it is a 12-year-old boy, very much. Is it 12-year-old boys? Point of view.
There's also the sort of very primitive side of it. I mean, it's in a world after a nuclear holocaust, and they're finding their way back to society. So I guess that does sort of appeal to men more. But I'm speaking on behalf of all the girls in the set, saying that we've enjoyed it.
And the only two women in it, one seems to be used for sex, really, and the other is a signal of death. So maybe for women it's not a great role model to read, but it's still, they can look at it and argue against it, and it's a great thing to read for both, like Naomi said, both sexes, I think.
I'd actually disagree with that to an extent. I'm writing my coursework on the differences between men and women in the novel, and I think both the female characters actually have a very strong masculine side to them, and Lorna, who takes Ridley's virginity, is very dominant over him, which obviously shows a bit of masculinity, and Auntie, who is the death figure, has a red-hot willy, so that is also a bit of a dominant.
So what do you think of that?
Hard to say. A little bit lost from that.
I think there's an ongoing theme in the novel that it's the idea that we don't know what we have truly until we lose it. I think women fit into that in the same way that fragments of tradition do, in that what's left of the past is so valued after the nuclear holocaust. Women seem to be quite scarce as well, and they're valued in their own way, similarly.
I was just going to say, let's not forget she who has her womb in Cambry, the divine feminine that pervades Ridley's world and Ridley's folkloric religion, the divine fertile presence that is redemptive, that we see in the resprouting of green vine, that we see in the plants that grow from the charred earth, that redemptive force that we see in nature is a very feminine one, and something that's not to be overlooked.
That was a group of Bristol Grammar School students who came to hear Russell Hoban at the Guardian Book Club. You can hear Russell himself in our podcast series by going to guardian.co.uk/books. I wonder if those intelligent and thoughtful comments will encourage those of you who haven't read the book to give it a go. I have to say, I was inspired enough to get a signed copy for my daughter for Christmas. And Russell does individual inscriptions, and I have no idea what he's written. It's probably something deeply primitive and malign and male. And that's the end of our rather busy week. I think I'm going to go into hibernation for a while with the squirrels in my garden. But anyway, I'm not going to have much time to do that because we've got lots of more stuff coming up looking ahead. Richard Lee from our book site joins me to give you the lowdown on everything else we've got going on.
Yes, in tomorrow's Saturday Guardian Review, we'll have a new short story, a seasonal one, from Hilary Mantel called Winter Break. And there's also a profile of the environmental writer and campaigner Bill McKibben, which you will find live on the site today. And in the Observer's new review on Sunday, the biographer Daisy Hay brings our week of coverage of the First Book Award to an end with a review of Romantic Moderns.
And let's hope she gives it the rah-rah it deserves. Thanks, Richard, and thanks to everybody else for listening. Next week is going to be all about children's books. I'm Claire Armistead, and our producer is Tim Mabey.
Downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.